Live from CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Thousands of Ukrainians crossed the border from Mexico to California following the Russian invasion of their home country. Many have chosen to stay in the Sacramento area, which already has a large and tight-knit Ukrainian community. CAP Radio editor Pauline Bartoloni has been following the migration of these refugees to our region over the past months and joins us with more conversations with refugees to find out why they're coming here, how they're faring, and where they're finding support. She also learned one of the biggest challenges for them was getting permission to work. Pauline joins us now. Good morning, Pauline.
Good morning, Vicky. Good to be here in person.
Yes, in person. It's nice to see your lovely face.
Likewise.
And thank you for joining us with an update on reporting that you've really been doing all this year. Do you have a better idea of how many Ukrainian refugees have come to the Sacramento area this year?
Yeah, it's a good question. There's not a firm count on how many are actually in Sacramento, but we do know that 22,000 Ukrainian nationals cross the border from Tijuana to California in just a couple months after the Russian invasion. And we know that a lot of them came to Sacramento because it's such a big Slavic hub. Some leaders in the Ukrainian Sacramento community say that as many as 10,000 new refugees may be here just settling in the past few months.
That is significant. And that's going up into just April of this year, that estimate. So how are they getting by? Where are they living?
Yeah, a lot of them are staying with friends, family. Some folks, Americans, have donated spaces in their homes. Churches are helping them out. As we've talked about before on the show, Christian churches are really the backbone of the Slavic community here. And so they're helping them find housing, applying for benefits. A lot of them are here on a one-year humanitarian parole. It's basically just you're allowed to be here for a year and then we'll see what happens after that. So they have to apply to work, which all the people I talked to were very eager to work. But apparently it's a very lengthy process to get that work permit.
Given that the country of Ukraine is quite large, I think it's comparable to, you know, the state of Texas. When you're talking to refugees who are now in Sacramento, I would imagine their experience of war can vary greatly.
Yeah, definitely. That stood out when I was talking to some of the refugees. Their experience varies in terms of how much they interacted with the conflict. One person I talked to actually came from Poland because they anticipated conflict in Ukraine. So they went to Poland before the Russians invaded. But one thing that's really in common is the long journey that they all took to get here, a lot of times without a destination in mind. One family I talked to, the husband's name is Mykola Chernov. He's here with his wife, Elena, and an 8-year-old son. They took 6 weeks to get here. They bounced around Europe. They went to Mexico, different cities in Mexico, before going over Tijuana. I talked to Mykola in a church in Orangevale, Spring of Life Church, about how they experienced a first day of the Russian invasion. They lived in a town called Nikolaev in southern Ukraine, and somebody helped interpret Mykola at that church in Orangevale. Here he is.
Були вибухи в нашому місті. Був підірваний військовий аеродром.
There were actually bombs, and they heard it from their room, and they bombed like a military station there near their city.
У нас було 2 години на збори.
He said he had 2 hours to get everything, and yeah, they left.
Нам нема куди вертатись. Наше місто бомблять кожного дня.
While the war is going on, there's just no point of going back because every day their city's getting bombed.
Yeah, so you could really hear that they experienced the siege firsthand. They came here because of Elena's cousin to Sacramento, and they now live in Roseville. They're getting some public assistance. He fixed iPhones back in Ukraine as a business, and so he's looking forward to getting back on his feet and working again here in the U.S.
You say that it took them 6 weeks before they reached Sacramento. When they first left, was the plan always to go with their cousin in Sacramento, or was it kind of open-ended?
No, it was open-ended. I mean, that was one of the things that really blew my mind when reporting this. A lot of people just left, you know, in Mykola's case, 2 hours notice, and they didn't know where they're going. So it wasn't until they were in Italy that Elena's cousin was like, you got to get here in Sacramento.
Wow. And with an 8-year-old at that. And each of these families and individuals has their own unique story. What other stories did you learn with people who are now resettling in Sacramento?
Yeah, I also talked to another couple, the Kulinkovs. They came from Crimea. And so Crimea was already annexed by Russia in 2014, and they always considered it part of Ukraine. But they said, even though Crimea was already under occupation this February, it felt like a new invasion. It felt really felt like war in February, and they felt like it was time to go. The Kulinkovs were interesting to me because they didn't know anyone in Sacramento. They didn't have any friends or family, but they had heard kind of through the grapevine on the internet that Sacramento was a welcoming place for refugees, for Ukrainians. So here I talked to Vyacheslav Kulinkov at the Spring of Life Church in Orangeville. He's also speaking to me through an interpreter.
Значит, в Ютубе я много смотрел роликов.
He was watching the YouTube videos and hear about Sacramento, the opportunities in Sacramento, big Ukrainian community, Russian community, a lot of people who speak our language, kind of from our countries, and understand the culture and can help with all like documents and just explain like where to go and, you know, just to make even friends.
So it's interesting that Sacramento really has international notoriety in the Slavic community, in Slavic countries.
Yeah, I don't really think I ever thought of the power of social media in this way before until just listening to him. Yeah. When it comes to the pathway to immigration, that has changed some in the first months of this year alone. What has changed and how has that impacted immigration into the United States for Ukrainians?
Yeah, definitely. It has changed. In the first couple of months, when I understand most of the new Ukrainians came to Sacramento, they came in this chaotic period right after the invasion. The first 2 months, they just were trying to get out, trying to go through Europe, came through Mexico, over the border to Tijuana. But then in late April, the Biden administration announced this program called Uniting for Ukraine. And that's kind of a more organized, streamlined process where Ukrainians have to apply. They have to have a sponsorship from somebody here in the U.S. who's willing to financially support them. And then they can stay up to 2 years.
So given that there's more organization right now, now something actually formal, Uniting for Ukraine, what are the main challenges right now?
Yeah, I mean, resoundingly, I hear from the refugees and leaders in the Ukrainian community that people want to work and that it takes a long time to get the legal paperwork to do so. It's just up to 6 months it takes to apply for a work permit. And the Ukrainian leaders say, you know, this population is highly educated. Some of them speak English. They're ready to work from the day that they arrive. Here's the Consul General of Ukraine in San Francisco, Dmytro Kushnerik, on this issue.
The biggest problem for everyone is getting the job authorization, because people are ready to work like the first days after they come. And we know that a lot of businesses are understaffed in California and in Sacramento area too. And so that would really help if people could work. But the system as it is not allowing to get for them this authorization quickly. So they have to wait for at least half a year.
Yeah, so a lot of the refugees I talked to are just in limbo, you know, hanging out, waiting for work authorization, learning English.
Yeah, 6 months can feel like a lifetime when you're trying to make a living and make an income for you and your family. So how are they spending their time here in Sacramento?
A lot of them are going to church events. The Spring of Life Church in Orangeville, as I mentioned, they've taken a very active role in having weekly Saturday evening events for new refugees to network, build community, listen to musicians and speakers, and their new refugees can go and get help with signing papers and learning how to make a DMV appointment or what kind of how to buy car insurance here in the U.S. And some of them are learning English. I actually went to a Russian library in Citrus Heights that has that had 11 new students come after the Russian invasion. And so they're really trying to speed up the process of integration and learn English and become involved in their communities.
You know, Pauline, I'm just visualizing people that have been through such an arduous journey with so much uncertainty at a church, at Spring of Life Church, perhaps sitting next to someone who went through a similar journey. That must be just kind of intangible how meaningful that is for them to find that type of connection at this point in their journey.
Oh, yeah, for sure. I mean, and Sacramento's pretty spread out, you know, it's suburban here. So it's not like you walk down the street and pass somebody by like, oh, hey. So these centers of the community are the churches, and it's just integral for them to meet and build networks from there.
What is your sense whether the new Ukrainians who are here in Sacramento, whether they will stay here permanently, possibly?
Yeah, I was actually surprised by this because I heard varying things. Some people are like, yes, I know I want to stay in the U.S. I want to get a job. I want to become a nurse. I want to study. I want to learn English. And I knew it kind of. And the war was almost like the impetus to start a new life in the U.S. And then other the Ukrainian consul general in San Francisco, he actually said something surprising. He was like, we don't call them refugees. Mm-hmm. We call them displaced people because a lot of them want to go back after the conflict is over in Ukraine. And they're just kind of waiting it out here.
Yeah. For individuals who didn't have friends or family here, where are they staying?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, I think some of the spaces are donated, but imagine there's, you know, more than one family in an apartment, and these churches are just helping them people hook up with that housing.
You began reporting on this, really focusing on Sacramento at the beginning of the invasion. We're now in summer, in August. What has surprised you throughout your reporting these months?
Yeah, I mean, well, at first it was just the resilience and the conviction of people to help those in conflict in Ukraine, despite all the chaos going on in their lives here. There's a big refugee community from the 1990s and 2000s, and they themselves got here through refugee status, and they wanted to help their family members. What surprises me now, with the new refugees, is just how they're embarking on this long journey, physical migration, but then also when they're here, they don't know whether they're going to stay. So just this idea of being in limbo, not knowing if you're going to stay or go, it must be very anxiety producing. And that was moving for me.
And we've learned just how integral Ukrainian churches in Sacramento are in being a nucleus of support. Given that you just mentioned that they're still providing these important services like navigating DMV and just kind of settling into, you know, a new way of life, is this sustainable? Are they prepared to continue to help these people for the long term if many decide not to return back to Ukraine and to call Sacramento home?
Yeah, I mean, my impression is they're in it for the long haul. I think they were doing charity work, missionary work before the conflict with Russia, and they had charities and orphanages set up in Ukraine. So I think that's part of their DNA. I think they're going to just keep on doing it. I imagine new refugees is new membership for them, too.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I think they're going to keep on going.
Before we let you go, you followed a family that you first shared with us in April, and they had this incredible journey to bring their grandson and nephew to California from Ukraine. How is the family doing? What are they up to now?
Yeah, I actually checked in with them last night in anticipation of talking to you on the show. And Dina Samodorov and her father, Volodymyr Andruschek, they got their four-year-old nephew and grandson, and he's integrating to the family. They're on vacation in Florida. They're visiting amusement parks and just blending their new family. Volodymyr Andruschek is back in Ukraine. He's still doing support work in the conflict zone, and he just brought a couple containers of supplies to Ukrainians.
What did he tell you about, given that he's this is an ongoing quest going back to Ukraine to help Ukrainians. What did he tell you last night about how that's going?
I actually didn't talk to him because he's in Ukraine.
Oh, right now?
Yeah, he's in Ukraine right now. He just brought a couple containers. He's amazing. He's 65 years old and, you know, doesn't have a really easy time getting around. And yet he's going back and forth between California and the war zone. But his daughter, Dina, she's the one who kind of quasi-adopted her nephew, who they got from the war zone. And they're just spending a lot of time blending the new family.
And Disneyland. Thank you so much. Thank you so much, Pauline, for the update.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
And that is CAP Radio editor Pauline Bartoloni sharing her reporting on how thousands of Ukrainian refugees have come to Sacramento. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, CAP Radio. I'm Vicky Gonzalez.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. 4 years ago, the city of Sacramento, in partnership with community organizations, created a free, safe place for children and their families. Youth pop-ups. From bowling alleys to movies, ice skating rinks, barbecues at the park, the list of activities and fun goes on and on. In that time, more than 2,000 youth pop-ups have taken place across the city's 8 neighborhoods, thanks to a couple dozen community-based organizations. And youth pop-ups are continuing this month. To get a status check on the impact these events have had on neighborhoods, I spoke with Kaying Heng of the Sierra Health Foundation, Pastor Les Simmons of the Simmons Community Center, and Mai Yang Thor of Hmong Youth and Parents United. All right. Well, Kaying, let's start with you. You're with Sierra Health Foundation and the center. I want to go back to the beginning when these pop-ups started back in 2018. If you can just remind us, how did they come to be?
I'm going to take you back to the winter of 2018. It was around the holiday break of 2018, December. And at that time, we were made aware of a number of youth fights that occurred at the Arm Fair Mall. And the center came together along with our community partners to think about ways in which we could create safe place for youth to gather. Not at the mall, not in other places, but in a safe place. And so the concept of community youth pop-up arose. It was born from those tragic situations. And out of that came this notion of creating fun, safe activities for youth on Fridays and on the weekends, times where youth really needed a place to gather and be in community and to participate in organized activities.
Pastor Simmons, I want to go to you with the Simmons Center. I went to a lot of the youth pop-ups in the very beginning when they first literally popped up, from bowling alleys to ice skating rings. What role does the Simmons Center play with these youth pop-ups?
I can reflect back on the day that Kaying mentioned when we started in 2018. It was through crisis that we started. The city didn't know how to address a lot of the youth fights surrounding the malls in downtown and Old Sacramento. And it was through the leadership of Sierra Health Foundation, Chet Hewitt, and our community that came together, had a huddle. And what was said was, we need to create safe space for our young folks. We need to create space for them to have leadership in planning these events, and it needs to be paid. And as a result, we've created the youth pop-ups, and the Simmons Center plays a key role. As you know, we have a NBA floor donated by the Sacramento Kings to host basketball. We have a lounge area for video games, a snack area, and then we have the community connection to be able to, when we say we're doing a youth pop-up, we get turnout. We get the right kids in the right place for a safe environment, a fun environment. And that's what was said of from kids. They said, this place is fun, it's safe. We get to plan the pop-ups, and we get employment and leadership development through the pop-ups. You couldn't ask for anything better, right? It's been very successful. We do two a month. We see an average of 50 to 75 kids at each pop-up, if not more. It's healthy food, it's healthy engagement, it's leadership development, and it's also economic development through ensuring kids have the resources that are on our youth pop-up planning team.
When it comes to the community organizations, there's a couple dozen that do these youth pop-ups, and these organizations are throughout the city of Sacramento, which is incredibly diverse. Pastor Simmons, what's unique about the community you serve in South Sacramento?
Well, as you know, South Sacramento is one of the most diverse areas in our entire city, and that cultural diversity actually is played out in our youth pop-ups. They see a reflection of their community. They get to know each other, get to know, you know, how each other thinks. They get to play around with each other, either through basketball, recreational sports like volleyball or dodgeball, our movies, our food, things like that, that bring people together. They take that relational, I call it relational equity, that they gain inside of these pop-ups, and they take it back to their community. So when they see each other on the street, or they see each other at school, they've blended. They've gotten to know each other. They've gotten to know each other by first name, by last name. They understand each other. And in turn, I think it adds a level of respect, a level of understanding, and deep relationship that when challenges occur, when we're not there and the adult supervision is not there, they know each other. They say, oh, I know him. I know Dante. I know, you know, the other kids, right? And it's something precious and genuine about that.
Mai, given that the name of your organization is Hmong Youth and Parents United, what would you like us to know about Sacramento's Hmong community?
You know, I've thought about this for a very long time. And, you know, the reason why I joined this organization is that for our Hmong community, when given the opportunity to do something and to make something better, we step up to do it. And we will challenge ourselves to do it. I think that, you know, our community, Hmong community in general, has gone through generations of trauma, generations of suffering, you know, migration, being refugees, and then coming to this and assimilating to this culture here as well. And now that, you know, our students are losing that language barrier, this organization, and hence the reason Hmong Youth and Parents United, is bringing and bridging that understanding that, you know, we're here together as family. Even though right now in today's society, you know, parents have to work, children have to go to school, there's limited amount of interactions and connections. But this organization is able to bridge that.
And these youth pop-ups are just one piece of what your organization does. You've hosted more than 70 events since 2019. Mm-hmm. How has it paid dividends to other opportunities and other foundations of support? Because you have other pieces of resources. I think when I was looking at your website, I love that you have youth circles, and it's provides mm-hmm. a safe space for a variety of needs, from mental and emotional to healthy and positive relationships to even peer-to-peer support and college and career readiness.
It really stems from the youth pop-ups, because when we first started, you know, we had to get, besides our summer programming, we were able to really dive in and engage, you know, the high school and middle school students to become a part of this. And from the youth pop-ups, you know, we developed the youth circles, because we noticed that our students that come out for these youth pop-ups, they need more opportunities than, you know, a safe space and engagement. They they're seeking for confidence building, for leadership skills. They're seeking to understand themselves, understand, you know, the current times and what's happening. And hence we have the youth pop-ups born from the youth, we have the youth circles born from the youth pop-ups because of the youth that, you know, has continually spoke out to us that they would like to be more engaged, to learn more opportunities. And in these youth circles, we're able to do a lot more, teach them about mental health, teach them to understand the generation of trauma that their parents went through so that they can understand and be motivated to do something better within their life so that there isn't that tension between the generational differences.
Pastor Simmons, going to the Simmons Community Center in South Sacramento, I was looking at the events that you've had in just the last couple weeks, from a Pipeline to Success program, which is so cool. It's a full house of students learning about plumbing, HVAC, earning CPR certification, and a $400 stipend upon completion, to a community block party, in addition to youth pop-ups. I mean, these are all related.
Yeah, they're all related and really work to provide precious resources and services to our community, especially in times like this when we see cost of living increase and challenges with, you know, everything from rent to home ownership to prices of gas to food increase. And then more importantly, historically in our communities that the eight communities that the pop-ups has really been focused on with the number of organizations, opportunity for kids to really be engaged at the time they need to be engaged on Friday nights and Saturday nights, right? It hasn't been there. If you look from Valley High to Meadow View to Oak Park, Del Paso, all the different areas, and you say, what's in those communities that are fun for kids to get engaged on the weekends and hangout spots? You don't see a nucleus of movie theaters, bowling alleys, racing for go-kart racing, all those kind of cool things you see in different cities, right? And so these community partners have gotten together through the support of Sierra Health Foundation and created not only a fun place that brings in their community, but also a safe space through supervised kind of spaces with leadership development, which is hugely important, especially during times like this. These community organizations were crucial during the pandemic and when things began to open back up to create these safe spaces. Remember, the pop-ups were birthed as a result of crisis and not having safe space and engaging space for kids to go to. And it was one, what I call engine or vehicle, that was used to address community violence. It's not the fix all to everything, but it is one step towards that.
Let's end with the fun stuff that is happening this month. Pastor Simmons, I'm going to stick with you. Do you have pop-ups for the month of August? And if so, where and when?
Yes, we do. We have two planned, one August the 19th, and then another following August the 26th. And right now, the youth are planning them. They always, you know, look forward to their huddle space, their weekly check-ins, and planning the youth pop-ups. The first one will be at the Simmons Center, and it normally is a link on our Instagram page, the Simmons Center Instagram page, because we do ask people to pre-register for it. And we're, again, grateful for Sierra Health Foundation and all the data points that has been used to be able to collect the information and really lift up where the pop-ups will be, who comes to the pop-ups, the times that they are, right? And so the first one will be August 19th. I believe it starts around 6:30-ish or so. Folks will check in. Once they check in, they will have a fun, engaging, recreational time at the Simmons Center that's built to bring all parts of the community together. And then we'll follow up with an additional one on August the 26th mm-hmm. as well.
All right, Mai, you have something. I was perusing your website, the last summer night market this month. Tell us what that's about.
Yeah, so, you know, our night summer market was something that our youth interns planned for because they wanted to, you know, continue one continuous event. So we've been having it since June, July, and now August. So The night market, this one, is deemed to be cultural because we've been having our youth interns learn performances as well to build their confidence. And this is going to be the time where they will come out and highlight what they've learned. We will be engaging our whole entire community to come and, you know, like, do dancing, to sing, and, you know, encourage each other. Our night markets in the past and also now, we will still bring our community businesses together as well to support and sell some of their items. We've had youth who started their small little businesses through our youth circles in the past, and they will be coming out to, you know, just sell the little handmade crafts that they've done, you know, just to build their communications and connections with the community so that it could build their businesses stronger.
All right, Kaying. These two organizations are more than a couple dozen that works with Sierra Health Foundation and throughout the city of Sacramento. There's actually a couple this week. Can you explain what youth pop-ups are going to be available throughout the city? I think the first one starts on Thursday and there's another one this weekend, right?
That's exactly right, Vicky. We're really excited about the lineup of activities that are being provided by our community-based, our nonprofit partners. The Latino Leadership Council is hosting Thursday night a virtual cooking where, you know, we're eliminating transportation as a barrier and everybody can jump online and learn to cook a few new dishes. It is about doing it together. On Sunday night, we've got three incredible community partners, Always Knocking, 21 Reasons, and SARS, Self-Awareness Recovery, coming together to sponsor an incredible bowling opportunity. Again, the end goal being we want it to be light, we want it to be informational, we want it to be fun, and we want it to be educational. It's an opportunity to bring our youth together, and especially during summer months where kids are more vulnerable. They're not in school, so we want to be able to give them opportunity to structured fun activities with adult supervision. Please check out our website at shfcenter.org. We will try to update information so it is real time. And, you know, youth who might want to be connected to a neighborhood pop-up event, please encourage them to participate.
And that is Kaying Heng of Sierra Health Foundation, Pastor Les Simmons of the Simmons Community Center, and Mai Yang Thor of Hmong Youth and Parents United. Sierra Health Foundation says since free youth pop-ups began in the city of Sacramento, there have been more than 2,000 events, totaling roughly 100,000 attendees, and there are several this month, including tonight. You can access a calendar of free youth pop-ups at sacpopups.org. We also have a link on our Insight page. Still ahead, a new project is seeking to capture the African-American experience in the capital city. We'll learn how the community can contribute to this project and highlight the untold and neglected parts of Black history. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. The city of Sacramento needs help filling in the gaps and painting a complete picture of African-American history and the experience here in the capital city. In collaboration with Sacramento State University, the city is creating the African American Experience Project to cultivate the Black experience in Sacramento. The team behind the project is now expanding so the whole African American community can contribute and highlight to this either untold or neglected history by contributing family artifacts, newspaper clippings, family photos, and even share recordings of conversations with their elders. Joining us now in studio to tell us more about the project and how the community can participate is Sean DeCourcy, Preservation Director for the City of Sacramento. Good morning, Sean.
Hi, good morning, Vicki. Pleasure to be here.
What conversations were taking place within the Preservation Department within the City of Sacramento that led to the African American Experience Project?
Sure. So your listeners may not be aware, but the city has a historic preservation office, and we're within the planning department. So we manage the city's historic districts, landmarks, of which there are thousands. The preservation office historically has been focused on historic architecture, mostly located downtown in the central city. And we've had an inherent bias over generations, really, that has focused on this history over ethnic communities, marginalized communities. And so we're really taking a hard look at our program and looking at how to reform it and revise it and look at these untold stories. And we're looking for the community's help to make sure that we do it right and that we're seeing the full picture of African Americans' contribution to the history of Sacramento.
When did you start getting this project off the ground?
So we applied for a grant actually in 2016 that was unsuccessful, that was a very similar project to create a historic context of African Americans in Sacramento from the city's founding through the recent past. That although we didn't get that grant, we kept at it and we identified another grant opportunity. It was about 6 months ago that we were awarded the grant, but it's through the National Trust for Historic Preservation African American Cultural Heritage Action Fund to do this project. And we've been working at it since then, and we've sort of launched the outreach effort in the past few months.
Is this a completely new endeavor, or has something comparable been done by the City of Sacramento?
This is actually a new effort for us to look at underrepresented and marginalized groups sort of individually, rather than our previous historic contexts have been focused on neighborhoods or corridors. We haven't really focused on a group or a community individually before in Sacramento. So we're looking at this as an opportunity to really sort of reframe the narrative and reframe how we do historic preservation, how we identify culturally significant buildings and historic districts, but also create a archive that we can pass on for future researchers to do projects that are similar to this.
Are there other places or other cities that you're gaining inspiration from and trying to emulate?
Yes, this is actually this is across the historic preservation profession. It's a fairly popular, I guess, endeavor recently. So other cities that have prepared similar studies have been Portland, Oregon, the city of San Francisco, Los Angeles, Long Beach, Santa Barbara. They're all at various stages of preparing these sorts of studies. And so this is, like I said, this is new to Sacramento, and it's relatively new to those cities as well. So we feel like we're in good company, and we actually have some things that are about our project that are fairly unique compared to those other cities.
How so?
So we have a component of the project where we've partnered with community organizations, and we had we call them our project partners. We met with our project partners early in the process to talk about the various components of the project that were scoped within the grant. One of those is this oral history component. So we partnered with students at Sacramento State in an oral history class, Sacramento State's public history program, to prepare oral histories. And these are sort of long form oral histories with members of the Black community. Well, the oral history class, it only meets every year. And there's only 10 students in the class. So we had 10 long form oral histories, which were great. But when we met with our project partners and asked them how we can make the project better and stronger, they insisted that Black voices be front and center, oral traditions be recorded as part of this oral history effort and passed down. So we have what we call enhanced the oral history component of the project by creating a way for members of the Black community to record their loved ones, their friends, family, and submit those to the city. That collection will become sort of a living archive, if you will, and housed at the Center of Sacramento History for future researchers. And it will also become part of this historic context, which is a document or a historical narrative that focuses on various themes centered around Black history in Sacramento.
I can only imagine it just helps the retelling of this important history come to life even more by having video and audio to go with the history.
That's right. And one of the things that we heard is that many of these stories are not found in archives or books or historical documents. These are oral traditions that are passed down from community to community, from church members to church members. And so to get those stories told, this oral history component is turning out to be extremely important to the success of the project.
Well, let's listen to an interview that you sent to us. It includes interviewing notable members of Sacramento's Black community and their experience in the city. One of those people was Ginger Rutland, a former print and broadcast journalist, and she spoke about the changes that she witnessed after she moved back from attending college on the East Coast.
Physically, Sacramento changed tremendously. When I left, there was no WX Freeway. There was no Highway 99. And those roads almost destroyed Oak Park. It hemmed it in. It cut it off from East Sac. It cut it off from Curtis Park. There was this ugly strip of concrete and smoke and cars and trucks that made it. So when I first came to Sacramento, I could walk from my home in sort of Curtis Park into Oak Park and go to the Oak Park Library and so on and so forth. And it was an easy, pleasant walk. Now, to make that same walk, I have to walk over a freeway. Capitol Avenue, with all of those high rises that are Capitol Avenue, that was a community, a burgeoning community that was torn down. The other thing that changed was Southside Park. See, Southside Park is split in half where the freeway goes through it, the WX Freeway. That park hadn't been split in half. It was, you know, it was the park. And I mean, they cut it in half. And I remember that park because that's where our family went for 4th of July. You'd sit in that park and watch the 4th of July celebrations. But that park was damaged by the freeway. I don't think they would have damaged William Land Park, which was in a whiter neighborhood. And all of that happened in the early 60s, in the mid 60s, when I was frankly away either in Europe or at college. And when I came back, Oak Park was a changed reality. All the stores were gone. They were boarded up. It was dead as a community.
Yeah, and there have been growing conversations in recent years, including here on Insight, about the damaging effects of redlining, not only discriminatory practices in terms of buying a home, but also deciding where highways and interstates are built. And we're hearing the experience and the consequences and effects of that through a Sacramentan, Ginger Rutland. What was your reaction when hearing that reflection from her?
Yeah, that's right. Ginger here is talking about a very important theme that we're focusing on in this study. And we can learn a lot about redlining and redevelopment and that story through historical research, but we can't really understand truly how it affected people like Ms. Rutland. And hearing these stories and archiving these stories and making them available makes them a permanent part of the record. And that's just something we can't find in historical documents and other conventional forms of research.
Who are some other prominent Sacramentans that you've interviewed so far?
So we've met with Shiloh Baptist Church, and they've become a very active project partner. And they have a group of members who were around when the church relocated from 6th and P to its location now in Oak Park. and we had a very productive meeting with them, and they're excited and eager to tell the story that both about the church and the relocation, but also just about their lives in Sacramento, and that relocation of the church from downtown to Oak Park is part of this larger narrative of movement and migration within the city. So we're really excited to get their stories as part of this narrative.
What have been some of the biggest challenges with this project, and how are you working to overcome them?
The biggest challenges of this project, I think that's a tough question. Early on, I think our concern was that we would not be able to get this project the attention it deserves. But I think what we've seen in the last really several weeks is that the community is extremely excited about participating in the project. And so I think when you ask what's the biggest problem, it was really sort of our fear that this wouldn't be appreciated by the community, that our intentions would be questioned. But I think that has not materialized. We've had a really, really great reaction from the Black community. People like Daniel Hahn have played an active role in the project. He's been a fantastic spokesperson. He's really excited about history and about making sure that the story that we tell is representative of the Black community. Like I said, Shiloh Baptist Church has been very excited and active in the project. So we've been thrilled by the community's embrace of what we're trying to do here.
Yeah, and Daniel Hahn is the former Sacramento police chief and the first Black police chief in the city of Sacramento. When listening to Ginger Rutland's interview, and it was lengthy, I believe it was about an hour, at the end of her interview, she said that these types of projects often focus on negative experiences. How is this project also going to capture the positive contributions and accomplishments by Sacramento's Black community?
Sure. So we're our office is sort of at its core, we're focused on identifying the significant people, places, buildings, neighborhoods that contributed to the Sacramento experience. And we do that through identification of positive events. And so we are looking to document and record and memorialize those positive experiences and contributions and significant individuals in the Black community. One future endeavor that we're hoping to sort of move to after the project itself is complete is this idea of commemorating places that may no longer exist. So going beyond the built environment and installing plaques or statues, monuments, murals, place naming, all of these things can be accomplished once we have the intellectual framework and the and a historical narrative that's supported by the Black community.
How can the public participate?
So tonight we are having a community meeting at 1901 Del Paso Boulevard. So that's really the first step in participating, is to come learn about the project, talk to us so that we can tell you how to get involved. I mentioned the oral history component. We do have a project website. If you Google African American Experience Project, City of Sacramento, it'll take you to our website and you can read about the project. You can read how to conduct the oral history interview. There's a tutorial video online that'll teach you how to do oral histories with your friends and family. We also have sample questions and a release form to make that story part of the permanent collection at the Center for Sacramento History. But tonight is the first opportunity to attend and learn more about the project. That'll start at 6 p.m. Like I said, the Sacramento Youth Center Theater at 1901 Del Paso Boulevard. We also have another public meeting that'll be very similar in educating people about the project. And that's going to be at the Martin Luther King Jr. Library in Meadowview on August 23rd. But tonight's the first opportunity to learn more about it. If you can't make it tonight, please attend the meeting on the 23rd. That'll also start at 6 p.m.
Given that this project is just about 6 months old, you know, it's still taking shape. What has struck you during kind of the infancy of this project, the stories and maybe the anecdotes that have resonated with you?
Sure. So we've gotten a lot of community feedback and great response from the Black community. I can remember one story. A gentleman called me just to let me know that he'd be coming to the meeting tonight. And he asked where it was. And I told him 1901 Del Paso Boulevard. And he said, oh, well, that's where I interviewed Rosa Parks when she was in Sacramento. And so stories like that are definitely things that we're looking for. It helps identify a place, an important event. And so and we're looking to add to the narrative.
Absolutely.
Like
that is incredible. Sean, thank you so much for sharing about this project. And also, we have more information about the event tonight on our Insight page.
All right. Great. Thank you so much.
Sean DeCourcy is the Preservation Director for the City of Sacramento, sharing with us the African American Experience Project and how the public can take part in this history project. That is it for Insight today. You can learn more about our guests at capradio.org/insight. You can also subscribe to the Insight podcast. If you want to join the conversation, email us at insight@capradio.org. Thank you to producers Nick Dobis and Victor Corral Martinez, with managing editor Aram Sarkissian. Our digital producer is Megan Minata. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones, and our engineer is Chris Feltz. Joe Barr is Cap Radio's chief content officer. I'm Vicky Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us. Have a great weekend. We'll catch you back here on Monday.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.